Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world, and welcome back to the OMG MotoGP podcast with former Grand Prix rider and British champion Keith Hewitt and myself, Harry Benjamin. Please do make sure, as always, you've liked, subscribed, left a review either here on YouTube or wherever you're listening to us. And if you ever have a question, query, comment, you can send us an email or a 30-second voice note over to omgmotogp@gmail.com. And I'm really pleased to say that joining Keith and I this week is another former Grand Prix rider and British champion, Steve Parish. Welcome, Steve. You've had a busy weekend, fresh off the back of Goodwood Revival and announcing your retirement.
Absolutely, yes. It was a frantic weekend, very, very hot. I'm still kind of trying to top myself up the water, amount of energy that was used and the heat that was down at Goodwood. And I'm about to set off to Mallorca, where we have a holiday home, and I think it's cooler there than it is where we are right at the moment. But no, I had an absolutely brilliant weekend. I said last year that I was going to quit. That was my last ever race. And then I got convinced by the fact that Freddie Sheen, Barry's son, said he would ride with me if I rode again this year. So I bowed out with the name Sheen on the results, and I was really pleased to see it. We did all right as well. We finished 10th overall out of about 29 starters, and most of them were flipping British Superbike riders and TT riders and everything else like that. So there was still life in the old dog as of yet.
Oh, brilliant. Well, look, we'll come on to more of that in a moment. But of course, we'll be looking back at some of the action from the MotoGP over the weekend too. But before we even went racing, Keith, this weekend, some hugely sad news from the paddock as the passing of Mike Trimby, the head of the International Racing Teams Association. A really massive loss for the whole community.
Yeah, absolutely a massive loss. I mean, Steve will be with me on this one, I know, because we've known Mike for a long, long time between us. I mean, it's Mike Trimby. He was a former motorbike racer himself from Hoddesdon in Hertfordshire originally. He had the first time Steve and I will have met him will have been at Planet Travel when he had a travel agency on the Kilburn High Road in North London. We go back a long time. He ran originally the motorcycle show, the Alley Pally. We used to get a call from him. I'm sure Steve did as well. I keep talking as if I'm talking for Steve. I'm sure he's got his own anecdotes to come up in a minute, but he would ring you the week before the Alley Pally to say he'd got a couple of stands that were empty, would you put your bikes on it or whatever you got as a display, and you'd get involved with Mike. It's funny, I was talking to a fella called and then of course there was Daytona and Macau, you can go through that, that's before we even got to Grand Prix. I was talking to Nick Morgan yesterday, MSS Kawasaki, good guy from down in sunny Essex, and he really sparked up a memory, and again Steve will be with me on this one. There's very little time that I can remember through motorcycle racing where Mike and Irene Trimby were major parts of it in one way or another. You know, I talked about the show, but of course we knew Mike from before that through the travel agency and the like. And every single point of your life has revolved around those two people, because they've either organized things or been friends with. And socially, you spent such a lot of time. I mean, we went to Las Vegas with Mike for his 60th birthday, me and my wife Venus. You know, they're this... It's going to seem a very strange place, But I did an interview with him on BBC Sounds, the BBC Bike podcast, which we'll put the link to it on the contents below the screen if you're watching this on YouTube or wherever, because it really sums up Mike. It's from Mike as well. It was recorded at Silverstone last year, 2022. And you get a real impression of what the man has done, what the man has been responsible for throughout motorcycle racing, and how he's dedicated his life, had no children, wanted to end his days in the manner that he did.
Absolutely.
All of a sudden, he was no longer with us. There was no real succession plan. Hervé Poncharal will take over as the spokesperson, and the rest of the International Race Teams Association will run without Mike and Irene, because I can't imagine Irene going back there after Mike's passing. But the fact is that he wanted to continue in his work right to the point. And he died on Friday night at the head of the table at dinner, feeling better than he'd ever felt. He'd been ill over the winter period, over Christmas period, better than he'd ever felt. I spoke to John Cooper this morning, if you want famous racers, JC. He'd been out to dinner with him in Misano, because JC always invited me and Mike out for dinner. I wasn't in Misano, so I couldn't go, but he went with Mike. And Mike said to JC, he said, "I'm feeling better than I've felt for months and months and months." And then Friday night at dinner, at the head of the table with the full-on banter, said he felt a little bit dizzy, gone. Just like that. The right way that Mike wanted to go. I know that's no consolation. Well, maybe it is a consolation. It was an empty restaurant that was just the Erta team around them. So it was a situation where he went with the people that supported him. Irene had the support of those people at that occasion, and it was no overly drama, which it's typical Mike. He organized it that way.
Yeah, well, I was with you, Keith, at the Royal Automobile Club for when Mike was awarded the Torrens Trophy, which is only 3-4 months ago. And I remember him saying, I think it was to you, he said, "I want to be carried out the paddock in a box." That was what he was planning to do, because he had no other hobbies. He didn't like golf. He'd lost his dog. He'd got nothing much else that gave him any interest. So arguably a bit early, and it's sad, but I guess we'd all take the route that we planned, wouldn't we, if we could? I feel sorry for the chef that night. Whatever must he have thought? I mean, I know I make funny things out of sad things at times, but I think sometimes you have to, quite honestly.
And I think most people will have appreciated that, Stephen, know the tone that it's meant in. I mean, Mike Trimby meant a lot to all of us. We can be flippant, because that's how you would have been with Mike, and that's how Mike would have appreciated us. I mean, the amount of times you fell out with the man over some of your antics.
Well, I was going back. I knew Mike before you, I'm pretty sure, because I shared a bike with him. I met Mike through Roger Keane, who we all knew and all loved and hated at times when the crankshaft wasn't ready. But anyway, Roger Keane introduced me to Mike. And Mike used to do the odd international race, and he had an early TZ700 that he bought from America, because he used to go out to the States and things like that. And Roger said, "Look, you want this young bloke, Steve Parrish, on it to share your bike at a, I don't know, it was
that
a 4-hour
race." That was a long time ago. Did they call you a young bloke?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, absolutely. I was even more ridiculous, a young up-and-coming star. So they got all that wrong, didn't they? But anyway, we went to somewhere like it was somewhere in Belgium. I can't, Nivelles or something, some weird track. And it was I still giggle about it, because the main event was going to start at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. But at 2 o'clock, they had this sort of invitation race where I think it was £200 equivalent in Belgian francs or something. And so Trimbo said, "Well, Stavros, you might as well go out and do this, get the 200 quid, and it'll pay for some of the diesel." So lap two, I fired it over the hedge. that was the end of it. And sort of cartwheeled his TZ700 down the road. So I became no longer this up-and-coming young superstar as this little knobhead that just crashed his bike. But that was sort of the first time I got to know him. But we stayed friends, and you're absolutely right. We had a love-hate relationship, which I'm very pleased to say ended up as a love relationship, because we got on really well.
Mike was a very intelligent man, very adroit, I think is the word. I had to look it up the other day, but it sums up Mike very well. And he's the kind of guy that you could have equals amount of fun with, but never step the wrong side of the boundary with him, because he would remember exactly where you were. And I can understand where Steve thankfully rekindled that friendship that was... But Mike was also the clumsiest bugger in the entire world. I mean, the times he would knock something over in inappropriate moments, or I've got these memories We used to call him the Honey Monster, because if you remember the adverts from the 80s where you don't forget to tell him about the honey, mummy, and he'd come crashing through the wall instead of the door. Open the door and come in. So we used to make this. Mike has always been the Honey Monster, and so I would ring him up. He would always answer the phone, Huggy, like he did every time. Yeah. But to some of the stories, Macau, there's endless stories from Macau. We could fill 10 podcasts with Macau stories. But the one that I remember really well, as a motorbike racer, you're always impatient. So there I am sitting in a car, hire car, and Mike's gone off with the keys to just deliver a document. And it is 35, 40 degrees in this car. I'm cooking like a bloody roasting dog with the windows, you know, no aircon, no nothing. I'm sitting there and I'm getting more and more and more annoyed. And I'm looking in the, I'm the driver. He's got the keys. So I'm sitting in the driver's seat and I'm looking in the mirror and all of a sudden Mike appears running, which you never saw Mike Trimby run very often. And he got his briefcase on the end of his dirty, great big long arms. And as he cornered around the corner, he stuck this briefcase, which must have been full of junk and I don't know why else, straight into the ghoulies of this little Chinaman that was walking in the opposite direction. And Mike was spinning out of control. Sorry, I'm terribly sorry, as this bloke rolling around on the floor, now emasculated in some way or another. But Trimby, he was a wonderful man who had great empathy for what motorcycle racers needed, having been one himself. But the way he managed to translate that from a time, Steve, from your era, which was fractionally before mine, where it was a massively dangerous sport and you were just like fodder for promotion. They paid you as little as they could get away with, never spent any money on safety or any of the infrastructure that was seen as normal nowadays. And people were killed every weekend, every race meeting you went to, if you raced on the whatever track they forced you to race on to earn money back in the day. Trimby was the first person that made a difference and continued to make a difference. His legacy is massive throughout the world. If you don't know Mike Trimby, which most won't, that's he's unheralded. Not many people know who Mike Trimby was. Only now will a lot of youngsters be realized, even motorcycle racers at trackside, even you know, your Quattararos and the like will be now looking at all this stuff that's now coming out from old folks like me and you, and stories and magazine articles and even the podcast that I said I did with the BBC. I mean, most people haven't bothered to listen to that. Of course they haven't, because he's a guy that they hardly know anything about. He's not a household name in motorcycle racing. Put that together now is what everybody's saying, and you get a mark of the man. However, the professional, Steve, got your phone on.
And it's only Chris Herring. Yeah. You're absolutely right. We all owe him a debt of gratitude. I think, you know, he's arguably saved my life and your life and many other people's lives, because the circuits, from the start to the end of my career of racing, 10, 12 years, Mike Trimby intervened and it got better. And it certainly got better after I finished and after you finished. So there's no question about it. You're absolutely right. But what a week it's been. I don't wish to dilute Mike Trimby. We lost Paul Bird, didn't we, at the start of the week?
And just a few weeks ago, Barry Mead from Mead Speed. I mean, I think that there's you know, definitely a trend at the moment, Steve. Maybe this will be our last conversation.
Well, maybe. And I'm not wishing to, I don't want any sympathy, you guys. But I lost my brother yesterday. And that sounds quite ridiculous. But it just seems to kind of go on, doesn't it, these things. And he hadn't been that ill. But I think what it does to us, it makes you realize that, you know, we're not here forever. We're here for a good time, not a long time. And you have to expect all these things. And I wasn't massively close to my brother, but still he was my brother. And I don't know, it sometimes refocuses you a little bit. But isn't it ridiculous how you refocus for 1 week and then you're back to your normal old grumpy self and carrying on? And it's fact.
Mm. Well, I think that you're slightly wrong there, Stevie, because you've obviously made adjustments to your life this weekend. You've decided that it's your last weekend of racing and you'll focus more on your boat in Palmer or wherever it is nowadays. I can't remember where your house is now.
It is out that way. But I've
made a decision as well on exactly the same thing. I think you look around and reassess what you want to do with your life. And I think there's a lot of people that are probably listening to this that are of a certain age that might be considering the same thing. Don't do it too late, I think is the point.
I think so, yep. And I often mention it. It was when Barry Sheen passed away, which ironically his birthday would have been 73 today. And I raced with Freddie the weekend. But Barry's last words to me, and he was obviously not long to go in his life, and I left his house in Australia, and he said, "At least, Stavros, we won't die wondering." And I've always stuck with that, because if we wondered about doing something, we generally did it. It's not always possible. People can't afford to do it, but do your very best. That's all I say.
Well, one thing's certain, Steve, we ain't going to die young.
No, there is no question about that. There's no doubt that we've surpassed that era, haven't we? But it's just been one of them horrible weeks. And all those people, we will continue, and they'll crop up in our lives. Something will turn up and we'll go, "Oh, well, that Birdie, he did this, and Mike obviously did that, and my brother," and so on and so on. And it just goes on, doesn't it?
But, you know, the time for me, and this will be the same again for you, Steve, because we parallel on this. You know, when you've had that intensity, you kind of... I used to think there was something wrong with me because somebody would be killed over the weekend and I'd be focused on the next weekend and you'd move on.
Yep.
But when you finish racing, suddenly your empathy returns and everything comes back to you, and you become slightly more emotional when you lose a friend or look back at friends you have lost. Yeah. But the time for me, coming out of Misano, I remember what it was like. And you packed everything up, you've got everything back in the truck, you're in the driving seat, and you're about to come out of the circuit, and you come past all the people still in the bars on the tents on the side, and you go to all the people walking out the track, and the sun's going down, it's all got a bit cooler, and you're a man down, and you realise at that point, as you drive to wherever, the next circuit, or you're going home, or whatever it might be, that you're a man down. And I think Trimby, there are probably more people thinking that coming out of Misano than even for any rider. I think Trimby has affected so many people over so many generations of promoters, of media, rider, owner, parents, over decades now, 40-odd years, he has been rejigging that paddock.
Yeah. What a picture that was, wasn't it? With a whole, I don't know if people saw it, but I've seen the picture. Someone showed me at Goodwood, the whole of the MotoGP paddock, which I don't know, what is it, 500, 600 people, something, I don't know what it is, but every single one was stood on the track with their thoughts for a minute silence for Mike Trimby. And I actually, it was my instigation at Goodwood. We have a driver's briefing, 30 riders, and I decided we'd have half a minute's clapping because I thought that was probably more appropriate in some ways. sad times, but exactly what you said, Keith. But for me, and the very, very worst was, you'll remember, Mick Patrick. The worst part about it was driving out of Cadwell Park and seeing a van and caravan left there. That even, it just multiplied the thoughts and terrible things. And I had to give his wife a lift home. It was the most dreadful, probably, day of my life, honestly, yeah.
Well, it's things like that, Steve, that Mike Trimby will remember. And that is the reason what inspired him at the time to make it safer for all of us. There is no man that's done a better job. I mean, he's done a great job. His legacy will live on forever. And Grand Prix motorcycle racing and all the other disciplines in motorcycle racing, because all of those things trickle down at the end. MotoGP rules are, as far as, track safety and the like, those ideas, those thoughts, those protocols trickle down through all the other classes eventually as well.
Mm. It lifts the bar for everyone, doesn't it? Yeah.
It's a massively sad loss, isn't it? And one that will be felt for a very long time, I'm sure. But it's nice to hear some of those stories there. Let's talk about MotoGP in 2023, Steve. How have you seen it? How have you viewed it? What are your thoughts on it so far? I suppose we haven't had you on at all, really. So, we've got sprint races. You a fan?
Yep, I am. I'm a fan of watching racing. And so... it seems to be happening in most sports now. Everyone, it's so commercialized, they have to kind of cram in as much as they possibly can. I guess it all started F1, which it often does. Things do like that. I think it's absolutely perfect. What do I think about this year? I can't believe, like most of us sat here, what Yamaha and Honda are doing, and Suzuki disappearing and Kawasaki not involved. And it's like the Japanese are getting their asses kicked. And if we went back 10 years ago, I wouldn't have believed it if someone had told me that the Europeans are coming and they're going to take over and do everything. So I think, to me, that's the biggest shock of the year, that they have fell behind in such a great way. And I don't quite know how they're going to gather their skirts up and pick themselves up. We'll wait and find out. I've always said in the past, I bet Keith had bet, oh, well, you never go far wrong with Honda. Biggest manufacturers that have been in racing so long, generally they come right. Well, they're going to have to get their asses into gear now.
Interesting as well, Steve, you should say that, because Mick Doohan, even the mighty Mick, who was Honda through and through, Mighty Mick said, and I wrote the quote down,
something needs to change regarding Mark Marquez, that is, I'd be looking at the best option. That was Mighty Mick talking about the situation between Mark Marquez and Honda. I mean, and for him to turn around and say something like that is pretty fundamental. Yeah. So the Mark Marquez story, I mean, the Grassini move to the Satellite Ducati team grew in momentum during the course of the Catalunya and then into Misano, but then slowly but surely started to subside. It's going in waves with Mark Marquez. Right. And of course, Mark Marquez is not dispelling any of those rumours either, which I think is fairly significant. He's keeping the, you know, the toes of the Honda Japanese to the fire until finally he makes his mind up. It's today, actually. We're recording on Monday. It's today that makes the difference for both Fabio Cannavaro. Yamaha have promised all sorts of stuff for today to test. And it's today where we find out whether Honda have brought enough to keep Mark Marquez on side or whether it spins completely out of their control and he decides to go somewhere else. This today, the test at Misano today, is the most significant test I think we've had, certainly this year.
Yeah, probably for a long, long time with someone like him as such a great champion. I still have a lot of faith and belief in Mark Marquez when and if he's fully fit and he can't be far away now. Would he finish seventh at the weekend? I think he had a pretty good run.
It was seventh in the end, I think. The most remarkable run of the weekend has to be the retired and wild card only Danny Pedrosa.
Absolutely.
Fourth place at one point. I thought he was going to pinch third. He did get a written warning at the end, though, because he was running lower tire pressures than he should have been.
The second ever written warning to be given.
Yeah, well, you're allowed a written warning. Your first one in the new rules this year has been a written warning for low tire pressures. But watch out. The penalties are coming soon.
Yeah, was that the carbon fibre frame as well?
There's the question. Yeah, they won't confirm it, but yes, I think that he has been running the carbon fibre frame, but whether he ran it in the race or not, I couldn't get to the bottom of that by the time we got to these recordings. So, but I mean, a remarkably tough Grand Prix, and one of those ones where when Binder crashes out and the quick KTM guys crashes out, and yet it's the little samurai who comes through to be fourth place and to be pressurising the top three guys. Pretty impressive stuff.
But as you rightly say, you very rarely get a test rider that comes out and sits up that far up the front there, and that's exactly what Danny is. And I love Danny Pedrosa. I mean, I've known him like you for a long, long time. But he came and raced at Goodwood 3 years ago, I think it was, and just slotted in there like the rest of the lads, bumbled round in about fifth or sixth place. I remember overtaking him. You know, it's like thinking, but he's just such a lovely lad. And I know, and I've read stories, and I often do, about him being a bit negative and not really joining in with everyone. But boy, you get him away from Grand Prix paddock and he's the loveliest guy and has a lot of fun. So great to see. Yeah, really, really good. Good job it wasn't windy. Can you imagine the carbon fibre frame of Danny Pedrosa on it? It only weighed about 26 kilos.
Flying. It was a fantastic result for Danny Pedrosa, and telling as well. The other KTM riders not able to keep up it. Well, at least Binder binning it. Unlike him, though. I just want to come back, though, to the Marquez and Honda situation, because I read an interesting article over the weekend, because obviously down at LCR they had they couldn't use Ikila Kuona this weekend because he was back on World Superbikes, and they brought in their test rider Takumi Takahashi. He failed to qualify or failed to get into the 105%, so he couldn't take part in anything. Now he won the Suzuka 8 hours, right? And that's obviously quite coveted. He's clearly not a terrible rider, but how does something like that happen? And B, what could they have used somebody else who could have had a better chance and banked data? Because at a time where Honda desperately need to finish races and gather data, from a Marc Marquez point of view, doesn't that look a bit, you know, why are you rewarding a rider who's, you know, he's won, okay, the biggest race for Honda this year, but he's not exactly going to deliver the data that we need to improve the MotoGP bike.
I'm suspecting it was part of his contract probably, and it was a little bonus for him. That would be how it would be with Honda. You actually said it right. I think it probably still is the biggest race for Honda. The 8-hour race is probably more prestigious than winning the world championship in some ways. And I guess it was his thank you very much for doing that. But it just goes to say, as you rightly said there, he's not a terrible rider by any means, but that is how far away I think possibly 8-hour bikes, stroke superbikes are compared to Grand Prix bikes. Now, pressing buttons and doing this and ride heights and everything else. And it would
discombobulate you the first time you get on it, I think. I'm surprised they didn't test it probably in Japan beforehand. But yeah, two sides of that. One is that Honda are so pleased with him for winning the eight-hour race. Wham, bam, there's your little Christmas present.
Trouble is, of course, Honda and Yamaha just do not have. I mean, Yamaha, obviously, Cal Crutchlow is testing in Aragon. He's getting ready for his wild card ride in Motegi in Japan later on in the year. Problem is, they don't have that great big run of riders. Look at KTM at the moment. They've got a you know, talent, absolutely logjam of it at the moment. The big deal is where is, you know, Acosta going to go? Pedro Acosta is looking so good at the minute. He's going to be, you know, right there in the Moto2 World Championship. He'll move straight across, I'm sure. Jack Miller is all of a sudden finding himself out on a limb. I can see Acosta taking Miller's ride and Miller being back in a satellite team anytime soon. So, sure. And the same with Ducati. They've got so much talent, so many bikes down on the grid. It's still, Steve, this is interesting because me and you haven't actually spoken about this, but I can't quite understand why Dorna haven't opened. There's obviously a political situation. I'll try not to answer my own question because I want to hear what you got to say. But there's obviously some kind of political thing behind the scenes that are restricting Dorna from actually being able to just say, well, we'll have a couple more KTMs on the track. Because that would seem to please everybody. It would give more bikes on the track, KTM a little bit more data and more in line with the eight bikes that Ducati have got on track. There is something that we don't know about that has restricted Dorna from being able to do that. Because surely we would all benefit, and certainly KTM would benefit and want, a couple of extra places on the grid.
Do we know it's coming from Dorna, or do we know if it's coming from KTM finances? Can they do that? That was often the story with Honda and Yamaha. They said, we actually can't produce enough parts or enough staff or whatever. But I can't answer the question because I don't know. Do you think it is coming from Dorna, or is it coming from KTM where they actually haven't physically got the assets and everything to do that?
I think KTM has shown that they're chucking the kitchen sink at it. I don't think it's going to be funding. And look at where the money's coming from. You know, the Red Bull situation, the Austrian situation. Well, there's a massive amount of money going on there at the moment. But I wonder whether there's something like, and Harry, this brings you in nicely with the Formula One thing, where, you know, you've got the Concorde Agreement that's in Formula One that restricts what teams can do and what can be done with the rules and so on and so forth. I mean, is there a situation where maybe Ducati have a veto over... You know, maybe Ducati agreed to fund and to supply more motorcycles to the grid to keep the grid numbers up when they needed grid numbers to be kept up. And so therefore Ducati said, yes, we will do that, providing you don't give the same dispensation to another team, perhaps. Maybe there's a contract in the background that is the manufacturers are restricting any more motorcycles unless it's a different manufacturer and not just a badged one. Like KTM have obviously got GasGas in MotoGP. So... Yeah. I just wondered, Steve, whether you'd heard anything along those lines, because you're normally sort of fairly well fingers in all the pies.
No, I haven't, to be perfectly honest. I can't answer that question. It does seem rather strange, but I guess what KTM have got to do is to build a bike that is equivalent or better than the Ducati for the teams to switch to those manufacturers. And you'd be rather a fool at the moment to chuck a Ducati back to Ducati, wouldn't you?
Mm.
Yeah, Keith, you would be, but there's a few people that want Aprilias, it would seem, at the moment as well. It's all got so bloody close, hasn't it? The Europeans really are kicking the Japanese proverbial butt at the moment.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing, though, Keith, right? You mentioned, obviously, on Monday, the 11th of September, a big day for Fabio Quartararo and Yamaha. You know, they're giving him a new chassis, new aero, new engine, all for him to try. If it doesn't go well, where does Fabio go? Where does he end up?
I should think with his head down the toilet. I think Fabio Quartararo, I think Marc Marquez has gone about it in the way that we all wished we could, in that he's very smart, politically very, very astute. He's not quite as emotive as Fabio Quartararo. And I think that Marc Marquez is really roasting the feet of the Japanese at the moment to make sure they give what he expects. And I think where that's going to come from, as much as in motorcycles, is in personnel. What he's going to be looking at is who are the teams and team leaders behind that motorcycle. He may be looking for changes there, wants to buy in talent perhaps. Yamaha has been the same old team for such a long time. You would wonder whether that is okay. Yeah, I know we got Ken Wozniakowski, I think in his, I can't ever say his name properly, sorry, and I apologize, but... Ken came in from Suzuki
And they bought in some talent that was cast adrift by Suzuki when they decided not to continue in MotoGP. And I think modern day racing is all about the talent behind the scenes. And maybe that coordination that we got from Rivola at Aprilia, Gigi Delinea at Ducati, that suddenly has become a model that the Japanese need to follow. And one that you wouldn't force them into in the past. It would be a Japanese crew and that would be it behind the scenes. But I get a feeling that they might be buying into the European perspective fairly soon. And we might see some of those talented personnel that the European teams have got being poached by the Japanese.
Mm. Well, yes, Harry well knows it's Formula One. It's often about getting the engineer and the man behind it. And the Japanese, I suspect, don't want someone coming in and telling them exactly what they should be doing because they've always done it themselves and it's always sort of worked, hasn't it? But you're right with Marc Marquez. He's not, I don't think he's asking for any more money. I don't think there is any more money in the world than he gets paid now, but he's asking for a bike, isn't he? And that's quite a strange situation to be in because it was always probably back in the days, and I can remember, it was who paid the most. You went there because you were pretty sure of your talent could make the difference on that bike and there wasn't such a vast difference in those machines. But I think the Japanese now need to go and buy themselves an Adrian Newey or something like that. Somebody to come along that has that ability to sometimes copy. You have to. You really do. And they are starting to do that now. And I think the main chief engineer is probably going to be the second best paid person out there to the rider.
I'll tell you what, I'm smiling away here, Steve, because Steve was my boss at Yamaha. When Steve retired, I went and rode for Steve when he ran Yamahas in this country. He's an interesting character, I can tell you that for nothing.
Didn't pay a lot, did I?
In between the wind-ups. I've always... With Steve, I mean, Steve's...
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Personality is probably front and foremost in most people's minds. But it's funny how Steve isn't really looked at, apart from people like us that are around the game, just how good a bloody motorbike racer he actually was. Right, and there's that kind of conflict between the joker and the motorbike racer. And that leads me really to our days where we drove the truck, we booked the ferries, we cleaned the bikes, we pumped the tires up, we did everything there was to do. We did our own spying around the paddock to see what other people were doing as far as gearing and any kind of little trick bits they were doing, and how simple the motorbikes were in just 30 or 40 years to where they've adapted to now. I mean, the changes are absolutely stark and quite remarkable.
Yeah. But in our day, and we go back to it, when you were riding for me, we did everything. We welded stuff up. We bored stuff out. We drilled things. Whereas now everything comes in a box. And the majority, I think they're called technicians. It was a mechanic in our day. The technicians nowadays are fitters, aren't they? They take something out of a box and fit it. I'm not taking anything away from them because they've got to be good at what they're doing. They've got to be precise and they've got to be methodical. But it's the engineer, the developer you need now. And I talk about Adrian Newey, who's a mate of mine, and people like that, that innovators, that they're able to get something, see something, make it better, have it made and fit to that machine. And your man was Adrian Gorse, and he was pretty good at that. Adrian Gorse would be like you. He'd walk around the paddock and he'd have a look what someone's got. And he'd come to me, see if I'd got the budget to do it. Generally, no, but I think it's so, so important now that you don't get left behind. And that's exactly what Yamaha and Honda have done. Maybe Suzuki was smart.
It's data as well, isn't it? I mean, that's the thing I think where the Japanese have been left behind. They've only got a few bikes out on the track compared with the likes of Ducati. And the data engineers are the ones that seem to make the difference at the moment. But you're right. Yeah. It's the Adrian Newey deciphering all of that data as it comes through. I mean,
It's enormous, the amount of broadband width you need a racetrack nowadays just to download all that bloody stuff.
Yeah, sure. And also the riders have to be able to look at that as well and try to adapt that onto the racetrack. We started with a bit of data logging, if you remember, but it was very, very kind of agricultural, wasn't it? But nowadays, I have to say, people say, oh, these MotoGP bikes got all the electronics on, but then about you, I don't know if I'd want to be sat on 300 horsepower having to press a button every time I got onto the straight and press this button and do this and everything else. I was well overloaded with just turning the throttle and putting the brakes on.
Yeah, well, the trouble was we got no grip and a power band of about 2,000 RPM. So if you tried to think about anything else, mate, you were going to the moon.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, quite possibly. But it is a completely different world. You're right. It's electronics. It's data. It's finding the traction that you require. It's finding the power band that's required. Or when I say required, to be better than the next one out there. And it is. It's a group of people that have to work very, very closely together. And then you need a young rider that can do what you tell him, not somebody that's got ways, set their set ways about them. And I think that's what's happening more and more. Kids are coming through, probably from PlayStations nearly, from the start, and can press buttons and do this and analyze data and see what's going on. It is a completely different world. Nevertheless, like all of us sat here, we admire those guys that can do it.
I tell you what, Tony on email has sent a question in, which might be quite apt. He caveated it with, it won't happen, I know. However, how close would a plus 130 kilogram two-stroke be to today's MotoGP machines if the current technology were to be applied to the 500s, benefiting from modern tyres, suspension, electronics, brakes and aero? Would they get close to keeping up, or is this current formula so powerful they would not even get within 107%?
I don't care. Let's see it.
Yeah, me too.
Come on, Tony. Let's make it happen.
Let's get the smoke. I don't know. I mean, it's very, very difficult to say. The only thing I was absolutely shocked and astonished at was when MotoGP four-strokes came in, I couldn't believe how much better than they were than the two-strokes at that time. It was extraordinary. We all said that the last two-strokes that Valentino Rossi rode and Mick Doohan's and people like that were fairly highly developed, of course, were the ultimate motorcycle, the animal that, well, I think they had 200 horsepower then or something like that, and they weighed 130 kilos or whatever. But when the four-strokes came out, I could not believe how they knocked 2 seconds a lap off the lap time. So, I don't know, very difficult, but less like Keith said, let someone have a go at it. Because, yeah, the injection is so much better now, the way you can build them. I'm sure there was an Australian company that was still working on two-strokes that reckoned that they could get the same horsepower. No, I don't know. Great, great question. Thank you for sending it in. We just need someone to build it. Who was it someone has built?
Suter.
Suter built a bike.
Suter built a bike that you can buy. I think it's a track day orientated machine. I think a comparison, Harry, one that you'll be familiar with, is the way that, you know, I love watching a YouTube clip of Ayrton Senna going round Monaco. It looks like the hardest car to drive in the entire world, and yet it's miles slower. Even though it sounds like it's faster, it looks like it's faster, but it's miles and miles slower than the boring hybrids that we now have that look easy to drive, but clearly they're obviously not, because they're arriving at a corner faster than that Senna would have. They're accelerating out of a corner faster than Senna would have. It's just the way technology has moved on, and the drivability, rideability. I mean, anybody can ride a MotoGP bike now. Harry, if you can ride a motorbike, you could ride a MotoGP bike. Whereas if you got on a 500 back in the days and tried to ride them bloody things, the second it hit the power band, you might find yourself in a little bit of trouble.
And certainly in a toilet. I can't remember the rider's name, but Keith will know Steve Wheatman has a lovely collection of old motorcycles, mainly Suzukis, pretty much all Suzukis. And he had a young rider riding one of his RG500s at Scarborough. And I was up there doing some demo rides, and every single practice this rider went out for, the bike came back on the trailer. And they kept doing this and doing that and everything else. And Steve said, would you mind doing a lap on it? And I did, and it was absolutely perfect. And the young lad had failed to realise he had to pull the clutch in and slip the clutch around the hairpins and was trying to drive it around it. And every time he went around, it just went burr and ground to a halt. And that is what Keith just said. They were finicky things to ride around. But I would rather watch Senna all day long going around Monaco, wouldn't you? I wouldn't give a shit about the lap times. Even if it's 10 seconds lap slower, it'd look faster, it'd sound better, and it'd look better.
It's an argument that is very pertinent at the moment, Steve, and one that we can go to straight away, because the point is that bikes are getting too fast for the racetracks we're racing on. And unless you can, you know, find a load more runoff at some of them, eventually they're going to outpace themselves. But the perennial problem that they now have is the only way that you can start roping back the development of production prototype bikes. It brings you into the domain suddenly of the production bikes, which are going so bloody fast, they could end up faster than Grand Prix bikes if we're not careful. So the whole job at the moment has moved on to such a point, it's almost a rabbit hole that everybody slipped down into, almost unknown, that is going to be really difficult to find a way back out of.
But why have the production got so good? Because they developed in the prototypes. And I often have this sort of little chat with myself and other people in that, why can you reel it all back when they need all the technology to build the road bike that everyone wants? And I can remember when everyone said, these wings, it's ridiculous. Why are we ever going to need that? You go down the showroom and buy yourself a new 1,000 sports bike now. What's it got on it? Huge, great big wings. Everyone wants them because they see them every weekend on television winning Grand Prix. So manufacturers are not going to continue racing and pumping millions of pounds in it when their R&D can't use it for developing the product. So you're right, it is. And going back to more runoff areas, who's going to go and watch a Grand Prix? I mean, I'll be quite honest, I don't go now because you're about, 400 metres away from the nearest you get to the racetrack because there's 7 acres of gravel. I'm not saying you shouldn't have it, but it's become rather, I don't know, it just doesn't work for me.
No, well, I understand exactly what you're saying there. But I mean, again, it depends on what track and pick your track half the time, doesn't it? I mean, some just aren't. But this is the argument with Silverstone quite often. It's one of the best tracks in the world to race, but not the best track in the world to be at atmosphere and spectator-wise. And that's a great shame because it's a fantastic, you know, racing circuit.
Oh, sure. But no, I completely agree. But that's just the way we've got. And if you want close racing and sadly going back into time and history, you go and watch at the TT or Oliver's Mount where you sit on the grassy bank. But I'm not saying that's right and you can't do that. Grand Prix riders wouldn't do that. But we have got into a rather sterile situation, I'm afraid. We don't get the kind of two-stroke smell anymore. We don't get the sideways action. And we're a long way away from the track. And I'm a grumpy old bastard.
And I second that.
We had a few questions come in as well. But a lot have wanted to hark back to your days, Steve, alongside Barry Sheen, and just Josh on Instagram and leads the way. He just wants some anecdotes, really. Like, what was, you know, Barry like on track, off track? What were the differences? Were there any?
A little bit. I mean, Barry Sheen was a showman. That's what made him so great and why it'd be so popular. I often apologize. And in fact, I'm going to do it right now. And now I've retired. I was probably rude to some people when I was racing. I think Keith would be the same. You're so wrapped up in your own little mind, what's going on, what gear are you going to use, am I going to get underneath someone turn one, and you're so focused on what's going on, often you ignored people. And I had numerous people said, well, that bloody Steve Parrish didn't speak to me when I did this, and I apologized because I was pretty much focused. Barry seemed to be able to switch himself off a little bit, in that, I don't know, he must have internally focused on what he was doing, but he was always so good with his crowd, his public, everyone out there. He'd got time for everyone. He annoyingly remembered everyone's names and had an incredible memory. But he knew how to live a good life in his early days of racing. Towards the end, it became a bit mundane, and I think he probably got fed up with waking up in hospitals wondering who he was and where he was through crashing so many times. But Barry knew how to live a life. There was something rather special about him. When he walked in a room, he was the George Best of motorcycling. It's an old anecdote, but he was good fun, and for me, and I get a lot of stick saying, oh, bloody Parrish just thinks he was famous because he was Barry Sheen's mate. Well, you should have been Barry Sheen's mate because he was a lot of fun. He opened up lots of doors, helped me immensely with my career, and I still miss him to this day. But I think a lot of people have got tremendous anecdotes with him and we'll remember him forever. As your email has just come in, I'm sure he was a huge fan back in the day. There's still in the pipeline, and I keep going on about it, there's still a possibility of a movie. There really is. A lot of money's been spent trying to put it together, but trying to find the lead actor to be Barry Sheen is extremely difficult. But there is somebody working on it, and they have been for the last 7 years right now. Ironically, 7 years. But what a movie it would be.
Barry as a personality was incredible. But I obviously was his teammate for a short period of time. at Suzuki. And the one thing that I can emphasize more than anything was the business. He knew the business. He had empathy with people. You're absolutely bang on, Stevie. He was the Valentino Rossi of his time. Could certainly, he always autographs. He always remembered people's names. That was the one thing that always I was remarkable about. His command of language, remembering people's names. But more than that, the business side of things, Barry always had always knew what to say in an interview, always knew how to work a business perspective every inch of the way. He was very clever on that front. And the fact he took no shit. He'd turn up in a Bortaco shirt when he was at a Yamaha do because Yamaha had pissed him off about something or the other. He was irreverent and right to the right point. I mean, even Breakfast Television, he's the first man that I'd ever heard call somebody, in fact, it was the Australian Prime Minister, he called a wanker on British Breakfast Television. I can't remember the name of the presenter at the time, but all he did was sink his head in his hands. It was a live show. And he curled up on the couch for Breakfast Television, as Sheen calls the Australian president, had the temerity to put his hand on the back of the Queen and usher her into somewhere. Well, you don't touch the Queen. That's just not what you do, even if you're an Aussie. And I just remember Sheeny calling it. And of course, Barry will have already worked out that he could probably get away with the word wanker. It was pushing the boundaries at the time on air, but he did. And he never got castigated for it. I mean, the complaints were very few, but the people that cheered Barry had it all worked out all of the time. Very good.
Well, he passed away 20 years ago, I think he'd have been in trouble nowadays, wouldn't he?
Fine a point on it.
But I've just had enough of it, frankly. Again, I'm going back to it. Do you know the other thing you guys won't know? But at Goodwood, for the past 2 years, I've worked with some actors there. When I say they're actors, at Goodwood, they have lots of different things going on. They'll have people going around with a suit on, selling watches and that type of thing that used to happen in the 60s. And they'll have dodgy policemen and so on. And I used to work with the road men, as they were called, and they'd have an old mini pickup. We'd wear tatty clothes and sweep in the road and lean in on our brushes. And everyone loved them. They'd been doing it for 15 years. And we got laid off this year because it was not PC enough, I'm afraid. Yeah. And it's just, the world's gone a bit silly, isn't it? And everyone was going, where are the road men? Where are they? I'll go, well, wasn't allowed anymore. But Barry would have probably been in lots of trouble if he'd have survived this time that we've managed to do so. But yeah, for the persons going, Barry Sheen was an amazing gentleman. Just as Keith said, knew what to say, when to say it, but also worked extremely hard, a bit like a swan. He might be gliding along on the top there, but he pedaled like hell below because he knew that he had everything laid out. He would have exactly the right parts. He'd get them because he could speak the Japanese language. He'd have the best engineers he could possibly buy. He would watch what they're doing. He would go along and make sure everything was right. Probably someone that we all looked up to at the time and people should continue to do so.
Yeah. Do you see any shades of anybody else coming through?
A lot of people are saying Jake Dixon, are they? And I like Jake a great deal. But can anyone ever be Barry Sheen again? Because you're not allowed to be, are you?
No, you couldn't possibly Sheen. You have to be yourself. There's no doubt in that.
Yeah, but you can't afford to be that cheeky chap anymore now, can you? Can you imagine Jake Dixon saying that? Someone, the FIM president's a wanker. That would be the end of his career, wouldn't it? So you can't do anymore. So I don't really know, but I just think it's going to be hard for anyone to be a character quite realistically now, because the majority of people that we see racing out there started when they're 6, 7 years old. They were ushered around by their parents because that's the only way they would go racing. They didn't necessarily have a shag behind the bus shelter like we would do because they didn't get, they went to an academy. The majority of the lads have all gone to academies and they've had people around them, managers and dietitians and psychiatrists, and they're not what I call normal people. And I personally think to be a character nowadays, you've got to be nearly a normal person. They become homogenized beings, and there's nothing wrong with that because they have to be. If you haven't won a championship at the time of 12, you're a history, aren't you?
Can you imagine if that psychiatrist and when we were on, half of us wouldn't get to the grid.
Well, absolutely. No, the psychiatrist would have needed one.
And it would have been worse if they'd done blood tests and the like as well. The amount of alcohol that was going on back in the day too.
Yeah.
And I don't condone that, by the way.
No, nor do I. And I understand exactly where sport, and I'm not just talking about bikers, every single sportsman out there now has to be a highly tuned, homogenized being that has gone through academies and have been fed correctly and watered correctly and psychologically tried to put into the ways that I even know some of the guys now that have this frog, the poisonous frog, and they rub it onto their skin and it helps their adrenaline pick up. And it's weird, very weird. The only frog I ever got on me was when I was drunk and fell in a lake.
How times change.
Not I thought we were heading for a nationalistic type.
dear. The amount of edits I had to do on this podcast week in, week out with Keith.
Yeah, God, I'm sure. There'd be plenty this
so
time.
Much trouble. Look, you mentioned Jay Dixon there. I think it's worth touching on some of the Moto2 and Moto3 riders and sort of looking at that young talent pool because, unfortunately, there is so much talent. But where do they go? Because there aren't many. Even to get Pedro Acosta onto the grid, it seems, in MotoGP is going to be a challenge. And, you know, he's just notched up another win. Arbolino's up there as well. He's limited some damage over the weekend. Dixon had a bit of a disappointing weekend that sort of halted his charge a little bit. And then Moto3, we've got Keith's favourite, David Alonso, once again victorious on the top step. Jaume Masia, Dennis Onchu, Holgado. Steve, who sort of catches your eye at the moment in those Moto2 and Moto3 classes?
All that you've just mentioned, but you're absolutely right. There's not enough seats and too many bums, isn't there? That's the situation that it is. Jake, obviously, I support him as much as I can because, like Keith, I raced against his dad. He was a brilliant rider on a 502 stroke. He was a great world champion sidecar racer. And so, you know, we support our own, I guess you'd say. And I don't really know, but it's not just this sport, is it? Formula One's exactly the same. There'll be queues and queues of people coming in. Unfortunately, some of them, it's the fact that if you've got a whole pot of gold with you, if you've got a wheelbarrow full of money as well, that helps, which I think is wrong, but you're never going to stop it. It's been the way of the world for a long, long time. And I don't really know, apart from, you know, increasing the grid sizes and that type of thing, I'm really not too sure what you can possibly do. Same thing, just a bit of luck sometimes helps. You always come to a crossroads and trying to pick that right one is quite difficult. So I haven't got an answer to that. I guess having a really good manager, having a wheelbarrow full of money and looking, being a good looking person that speaks well, then that's what you've got to do. Like most things in this life, you've got to do better than the next person to get the top job.
Yeah.
We'd have a job to get past club racing nowadays.
Wow, wouldn't we just? Yeah, I say my biggest accolade, I think, is I'm celebrating nearly 50 years without a proper job.
Yeah. that is a brilliant achievement.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, I use the F1 analogy that you brought up. You know, there is a lot of talent that are not going to get to Formula One. Because there is a lot of talent already on the Formula One grid, but they started quite young and they're having longer and longer careers than ever before. I mean, you look at Fernando Alonso and Lewis Hamilton, still going into their 40s, top of their game. Keith, do you think we're going to see that in MotoGP with these youngsters coming in, staying longer and longer and longer, and then just, you know, hogging the seats that might go to young talent?
Well, we'd said it before about Marc Marquez. It looked like he was going to go on to win, you know, 10 world titles, 12 world titles or whatever it is, and then it started to come apart. You know, how long will Marc Marquez still be in Grand Prix? He's heading for, 30 years old now towards. Yeah, you can't predict in motorbike racing. Somebody runs out of motivation, runs out of, you know, physicality if they've hurt themselves at some stage or another. So you don't really know. I think the turnover is probably going to be greater in bike sport because you can't clatter yourself quite as much as, you know, is the possibility in bike racing. So I think that there is that turnover, but the logjam is massive. I mean, there's so much talent coming through at the moment. You've only got to look at the state, you know, and try to pick who's going to be the right one. I think the rider market is so good at the moment that they're getting them at a cheap price as well because there's so many there. You've not got to pay the kind of money you would have to pay to have a, you know, Alonso, for instance, coming through the Colombian at the moment. I mean, he's a rookie in Moto3 and, you know, third win of the year all of a sudden, and he's looking really, really, really good. And you would start to be putting some money on him. You would be trying to groom him towards the best teams that are available. But he might, next week, he might go and leg himself off somewhere and all that investment is gone. It's a very, very difficult. It's almost like running a roulette wheel. I mean, yeah, we've got a lot of talent coming through, but it's still unpredictable as to who's going to go where and who's going to go well on the next step up. You know, Moto 3 to Moto 2, Moto 2 to Moto GP. The only thing I would have said, and I keep banging the drum about this, we should have two more bikes on the Moto GP grid. You know, that should happen. And I can't understand why it doesn't. And no one, Mike Trimby, I spoke to Mike Trimby, bless him, you know, a week ago about it when we were in Barcelona. I said, is it never going to happen? He said, well, it's set for other manufacturers. You know, but it still didn't make sense to me. You know, Mike can only let you know so much as a friend what was going on behind the scenes. The reason why Mike was so stressed in Barcelona prior to Misano, where they were going, was because they were putting together all the things that we are going to learn about in the last part of the season, moving into 2024, when there's a lot of changes coming our way. So to put all the detail into that, and as it's become more complex and everything's become a lot closer racing-wise and rule-wise, you know, those details have to be spot on. You can't leave a gap in the rules or a sentence, you know, dotted in the wrong place or the like. So it's become much more crucial to get it right. But from a rider perspective, I think we've got a glut of very, very, very good riders for all the reasons Steve said. They start so young, they've got good management, and they've got good money.
I actually remember racing with Lewis Hamilton down somewhere in a go-kart, like you say, when he was about 10 years old. So, yeah, the career is enormous, isn't it, going through that? And I reiterate what Keith said. I've spoken about riders having dietitians, psychiatrists, and teams almost certainly have got very good lawyers sitting around looking for any little loophole that they can find, which has happened in Formula One for many, many years. Simply because if you can find a tiny loophole and you can use it for, it's usually only about three or four races because everyone else gets on the bandwagon, but they're the sort of things that win races now. And it's happened, doesn't it, over the period of time where, oh, you can't use that, but doesn't say you can't use that. And again, this is a lot to do with winning races. It's not necessarily always on the track, is it? It's the way you look at the rules and regulations. And some people might say it's cheating, which I was accused of on numerous occasions, but it was only the loopholes. Don't look like that, Keith Ewan.
Stavros, I've got so many stories of actually not cheating. And I think the point you're making is that a rule is a rule and it's there to be got around. And I mean, that's fair enough. Well, if it's legal to get around, then you get around it and you try to get around it. And you did have a reputation for being a bit of a joker and occasionally the man to stretch the rules as far as you could. But back in the day, I think it was easier than it is now to have done that kind of thing. I mean,
it was. But that's why, you know, the guys have got teams, have got lawyers and people that know every sort of little bit about it. Back in our day, half of us couldn't even read, should we? So we just didn't know. There wasn't that many rules, was it? You turned up with your bike, 500cc capacity, I guess it was, whatever you want. Simple as that. It really was, wasn't it?
Pretty much.
Whatever tyres you wanted. I don't think there was anything other than the fact that it couldn't be more than four cylinders from my era, 500cc's. You could put on any brakes you wanted. You put an airing fairing as long as it didn't go over the front wheel. That was about it.
And probably significant is you could turn up at the Grand Prix, turn up at the gate on a Thursday and talk your way into the grid to ride in that Grand Prix that weekend, providing you got a ticket from your federation. A Trimby story.
Yeah.
Good old Mike. Yeah. We'll go back to Mike, shall we? So I'm in Mike Trimby's motorhome and I am absolutely fizzing with rage. Irene's in the corner. My girlfriend then, Carolyn, mother of my eldest daughter, Lauren, is down the other end trying to calm me down because I've turned up at this racetrack. He's Assen. So it was a major one. It was the Dutch TT, which is important to all of it. And I've turned up there and I want to be on the grid. And as far as I'm aware, you know, my federation, the ACU, Auto Cycle Union, have done their paperwork, but they hadn't done any paperwork at all. I turn up and they said, no, we've not had anything from the ACU. And at that point where I'm absolutely exploding, knock, knock, knock on Mike Trimby's door, and it's Doug Barnfield from the ACU. God bless him. He's no longer with us, was killed in a motorcycle accident. But Doug Barnfield is at the door. And as I've reached for his throat and tried to get him, Trimby, all in one movement, has managed to get my belt and hold me back. And luckily, Trimby's much larger than me, so he's pulled me back out of the way. But that was the kind of way that we went Grand Prix racing back in the day. It was a situation. You turned up at a track and basically bullshitted your way onto the grid. And the grids were were far too big for the event. You would be allowed out to put a time down. And if your time was reasonable, you were in the Grand Prix. It was like club racing only 40 years ago. The likes of Trimby and Co. have improved it to the professionalism that we have today.
I think, Assel would have had at least 55 riders going for 40 on the grid. There was 40 on the grid, I think, back then, but there'd been about 15 that didn't qualify, and that was pretty much how it was. But there we go. I'm sure the youngsters listening to this or whatever probably can't even appreciate and imagine what it's like, but it was pretty tough out there. There wasn't much money around out there, but boy, did we have some fun. If you didn't qualify, you partied even harder.
every cloud.
Yeah.
Well, look, I think that brings us nicely to the end of the show. Thank you to everyone who sent in a question. Steve, thank you so much for giving us your time. Who's going to be the 2023 MotoGP champion?
I'm always going for the favourite. I'm sure Bagnaia is going to be the man. I can't believe how good the protective clothing is. That's another thing we've got to talk about. That accident, I watched that happen and thought, that's him out for the year. Just astonished that he could come back with a broken metacarpal, I think it was, on his hand and little bone in his ankle. Extraordinary. But he seems a really smart lad. That's probably given him a bit of a warning as to just back it up a little bit. And did he get third, didn't he, I think, at the weekend?
Just extraordinary. You were talking about Bastianini. He's a metacarpal on the hand. I mean, actually, Bagnaia only ended up with bruising. When he got run over by Binder, I thought we were going to end up with an Ian Hutchinson situation.
Me too.
And Binder ran him over, and I thought that's going to be Magnolia for the year. But to come back and podium, look as good as he does on that is not an easy track. 27 laps around Misano in that kind of heat for someone who's had a clattering just a week earlier, pretty impressive. So, I'm with you. I think Magnolia's
going back. What we saw about and Harry was saying about the age. There's one thing that young kids like him and youth gives you, and that's you're pretty fearless. You know, you bounce and you bumble around. But when you get older, when you get 30 plus, apart from the enigma of Jeremy McWilliams, you just lose a little bit of fire in your belly, and you just realise that it can be painful. And do you want to keep smashing yourself to bits? And that's what's great when you're 20 years old, I think. So anyway, that's my money's on him, but it's not much of a gamble, is it?
No, we'll hold you to that though, because you never know in MotoGP land. Look, again, thank you for your time. Thank you so much for sending questions. That is our lot for this week. But OMG MotoGP Extra will be here on Thursday with Keith and myself for a little 15-minute update. I'm sure we'll have some fallout from the testing that's going on right now. I'm sure with other news cropping up too. So do stay tuned across the OMG MotoGP socials for that. Like, subscribe, leave a review, all that jazz. You should know how to do it by now. I ask you every single week, but we really appreciate it. Every review and like and subscribe goes such a long way. But from myself, Harry Benjamin, from Steve Parrish, and from Keith Hewan, we'll see you next time. Bye bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.